The Forever War, Disc 4.
The maintenance crew managed to patch up the huge rip in the side of the anniversary and to repressurize that section. We spent the rest of the day cleaning up the area, without, of course, disturbing any of the precious evidence for which the Commodore was willing to sacrifice his career. The hardest part was jettisoning the bodies. It wasn't so bad except for the ones whose suits had burst. I went to Estelle's cabin the next day, as soon as she was off duty. "It wouldn't serve any good purpose for you to see her now." Estelle sipped her drink, a mixture of ethyl alcohol, citric acid, and water, with a drop of some ester that approximated the aroma of orange rind. "Is she out of danger?"
"Not for a couple of weeks.
Let me explain." She set down her drink and rested her chin on interlaced fingers. "This sort of injury would be fairly routine under normal circumstances. Having replaced the lost blood, we'd simply sprinkle some magic powder into her abdominal cavity and paste her back up, have her hobbling around in a couple of days. But there are complications. Nobody's ever been injured in a pressure suit before. So far, nothing really unusual has cropped up, but we want to monitor her innards very closely for the next few days. Also, we were very concerned about peritonitis. You know what peritonitis is?"
"Yes."
"Well, vaguely. Because a part of her intestine had ruptured under pressure, we didn't want to settle for normal prophylaxis because a lot of the contamination had impacted on the peritoneum under pressure. To play it safe, we completely sterilized the whole shebang, the abdominal cavity and her entire digestive system, from the duodenum south. Then, of course, we had to replace all of her normal intestinal flora, now dead, with a commercially prepared culture. Still standard procedure, but not normally called for unless the damage is more severe."
"I see."
And it was making me a little queasy. Doctors don't seem to realize that most of us are perfectly content not having to visualize ourselves as animated bags of skin filled with obscene glop. This in itself is enough reason not to see her for a couple of days. The changeover of intestinal flora has a pretty violent effect on the digestive system. Not dangerous, since she's under constant observation, but tiring and, well, embarrassing. With all of this, she would be completely out of danger if this were a normal clinical situation, but we're decelerating at a constant 1.5 G's, and her internal organs have gone through a lot of jumbling around. You might as well know that if we do any blasting, anything over about 2 G's, she's going to die.
But we're bound to go over 2 on the final approach. What?
I know. But that won't be for a couple of weeks. Hopefully she will have mended by then. William, face it, it's a miracle she survived to get into surgery. So there's a big chance she won't make it back to Earth. It's sad. She's a special person, the special person to you, maybe, but we've had so much death. You ought to be getting used to it. Come to terms with it. I took a long pull at my drink, identical to hers except for the citric acid.
"You're getting pretty hard-boiled."
"Maybe. No, just realistic. I have a feeling we're headed for a lot more death and sorrow."
"Not me. As soon as we get to Stargate, I'm a civilian."
"Don't be so sure." The old familiar argument. "Those clowns who signed us up for 2 years can just as easily make it 4,
or 6, or 20, or the duration. But they won't. It would be mutiny."
"I don't know. If they could condition us to kill on cue, they can condition us to do almost anything. Re-enlist."
That was a chiller. Later on, we tried to make love, but both of us had too much to think about. I got to see Mary Gay for the first time about a week later. She was wan, had lost a lot of weight, and seemed very confused. Doc Wilson assured me that it was just the medication. They hadn't seen any evidence of brain damage. She was still in bed, still being fed through a tube. I began to get very nervous about the calendar. Every day there seemed to be some improvement, but if she was still in bed when we hit that collapsar push, she wouldn't have a chance. I couldn't get any encouragement from Doc Wilson or Estelle. They said it depended on Mary Gay's resilience. The day before the push, they transferred her from bed to Estelle's acceleration couch in the infirmary. She was lucid and was taking food orally, but she still couldn't move under her own power, not at 1.5 G's. I went to see her. Heard about the course change? We have to go through Aleph 9 to get back to Tet 38. 4 more months on this damn hulk. But another 6 years combat pay when we get back to Earth.
That's good.
Ah, just think of the great things we'll...
William?
I let it trail off. Never could lie.
Don't try to jolly me. Tell me about vacuum welding, about your childhood, anything. Just don't bullshit me about getting back to Earth.
She turned her face to the wall.
I heard the doctors talking out in the corridor, one morning when they thought I was asleep. But it just confirmed what I already knew, the way everybody'd been moping around. So tell me, you were born in New Mexico in 1975. What then? Did you stay in New Mexico? Were you bright in school? Have any friends, or were you too bright, like me? How old were you when you first got sacked?
We talked in this vein for a while, uncomfortable. An idea came to me while we were rambling, and when I left Mary Gay, I went straight to Dr. Wilson. We're giving her a 50-50 chance, but that's pretty arbitrary. None of the published data on this sort of thing really fits.
But it is safe to say that her chances of survival are better the less acceleration she has to endure.
Certainly, for what it's worth. The Commodore's going to take it as gently as possible, but that'll still be 4 or 5 G's. 3 might even be too much. We won't know until it's over.
I nodded impatiently. Yes, but I think there's a way to expose her to less acceleration than the rest of us.
If you've developed an acceleration shield, he said, smiling, you'd better hurry and file a patent. You could sell it for a considerable...
No, Doc, it wouldn't be worth much under normal conditions. Our shells work better and they evolved from the same principles.
Explain away.
We put Mary Gay into a shell and flood...
Wait, absolutely not. A poorly fitting shell was what caused this in the first place. And this time, she'd have to use somebody else's.
I know, Doc, let me explain. It doesn't have to fit her exactly as long as the life support hookups can function. The shell won't be pressurized on the inside. It won't have to be, because she won't be subjected to those thousands of kilograms per square centimeter pressure from the fluid outside.
I'm not sure I follow.
It's just an adaptation of... You've studied physics, haven't you?
A little bit in medical school. My worst courses after Latin.
Do you remember the principle of equivalence?
I remember there was something by that name, something to do with relativity, right?
Uh-huh. It means that there's no difference being in a gravitational field and being in an equivalent accelerated frame of... It means that when the anniversary is blasting 5 G's, the effect on us is the same as if it were sitting on its tail on a big planet, on one with 5 G's surface gravity.
Seems obvious.
Maybe it is. It means that there's no experiment you could perform on the ship that could tell you whether you were blasting or just sitting on a big planet.
Sure there is. You could turn off the engines and if...
Or you could look outside. Sure, I mean isolated physics lab type experiments.
All right, I'll accept that. So,
you know Archimedes' law?
Sure, the fake crown. That's what always got me about physics. They make a big to-do about obvious things, and when it gets to the rough parts...
Archimedes' law says that when you immerse something in a fluid, it's buoyed up by a force equal to the weight of the fluid it displaces.
That's reasonable.
And that holds no matter what kind of gravitation or acceleration you're in. In a ship blasting at 5 G's, the water displaced, if it's water, weighs 5 times as much as regular water at 1 G.
Sure.
So, if you float somebody in the middle of a tank of water so that she's weightless, she'll still be weightless when the ship is doing 5 G's.
Oh, hold on, son. You had me going there, but it won't work.
Why not? I was tempted to tell him to stick to his pills and stethoscopes and let me handle the physics, but it was a good thing I didn't. What happens when you drop a wrench in a submarine?
Submarine?
That's right. They work by Archimedes.
Ouch, you're right. Jesus, hadn't thought it through. That wrench falls right to the floor, just as if the submarine weren't weightless.
He looked off into space, tapping a pencil on the desk.
What you describe is similar to the way we treat patients with severe skin damage, like burns on Earth. But it doesn't give any support to the internal organs, the way the acceleration shells do, so it wouldn't do Mary Gay any good. I stood up to go. Sorry I wasted. Hold on there, though. Just a minute. We might be able to use your idea part way.
How do you mean?
I wasn't thinking it through either. The way we normally use the shells is out of the question for Mary Gay, of course. I didn't like to think about it. Takes a lot of hypno-conditioning to lie there and have oxygenated fluorocarbon forced into every natural body orifice and one artificial one. I fingered the valve fitting embedded above my hip bone.
Yeah, that's obvious. It'd tear her. Say, you mean low pressure?
That's right. We wouldn't need thousands of atmospheres to protect her against 5 G's straight-line acceleration. That's only for all the swerving and dodging. I'm going to call maintenance. Get down to your squad bay. That's the one we'll use. Dalton will meet you there.
5 minutes before injection into the collapsar field, and I started the flooding sequence. Mary Gay and I were the only ones in shells. My presence wasn't really vital since the flooding and emptying could be done by control, but it was safer to have redundancy in the system. And besides, I wanted to be there. It wasn't nearly as bad as the normal routine. None of the crushing, bloating sensation. You were just suddenly filled with the plastic-smelling stuff. You never perceived the first moments when it rushed in to replace the air in your lungs. And then there was a slight acceleration. And then you were breathing air again, waiting for the shell to pop, then unplugging and unzipping and climbing out. Mary Gay's shell was empty. I walked over to it and saw blood.
She hemorrhaged.
Doc Wilson's voice echoed sepulchrally. I turned, eyes stinging, and saw him leaning in the door to the locker alcove. He was unaccountably, horribly, smiling.
Which was expected. Dr. Harmony's taking care of it. She'll be just fine.
Chapter 6 Mary Gay was walking in another week, confraternizing in 2, and pronounced completely healed in 6. 10 long months in space, and it was army, army, army all the way.
calisthenics, meaningless work details, compulsory lectures. There was even talk that they were going to reinstate the sleeping roster we'd had in basic, but they never did, probably out of fear of mutiny. A random partner every night wouldn't have set too well with those of us who'd established more or less permanent pairs. All this crap, this insistence on military discipline, bothered me, mainly because I was afraid it meant they weren't going to let us out. Mary Gay said I was being paranoid. They only did it because there was no other way to maintain order for 10 months. Most of the talk, besides the usual bitching about the army, was speculation about how much Earth would have changed and what we would do when we got out. We'd be fairly rich. 26 years' salary all at once. Compound interest, too. The $500 we'd been paid for our first month in the army had grown to over $1,500. We arrived at Stargate in late 2023, Greenwich date. The base had grown astonishingly in the nearly 17 years we had been on the Yod 4 campaign. It was one building, the size of Tycho City, housing nearly 10,000. There were 78 cruisers, the size of Anniversary or larger, involved in raids on Torren-held portal planets. Another 10 guarded Stargate itself, and 2 were in orbit waiting for their infantry and crew to be out-processed. One other ship, the Earth's Hope 2, had returned from fighting and had been waiting at Stargate for another cruiser to return. They had lost 2/3 of their crew, and it was just not economical to send a cruiser back to Earth with only 39 people aboard. 39 confirmed civilians. We went planetside in 2 scout ships. Chapter 7. General Botsford, who had only been a full major the first time we met him, when Stargate was 2 huts and 24 graves, received us in an elegantly appointed seminar room. He was pacing back and forth at the end of the room in front of a huge holographic operations chart. "You know," he said too loud and then more conversationally, "you know that we could disperse you into other strike forces and send you right out again. The Elite Conscription Act has been changed now, 5 years subjective in service instead of 2. And I don't see why some of you don't want to stay in. Another couple of years and compound interest would make you independently wealthy for life. Sure, you took heavy losses, but that was inevitable. You were the first. Things are going to be easier now. The fighting suits have been improved. We know more about the Torrens' tactics. Our weapons are more effective. There's no need to be afraid." He sat down at the head of the table and looked at nobody in particular. "My own memories of combat are over a half century old. To me, it was exhilarating, strengthening. I must be a different kind of person than all of you." Or have a very selective memory, I thought. "But that's neither here nor there. I have one alternative to offer you, one that doesn't involve direct combat. We're very short of qualified instructors. The force will offer any one of you a lieutenancy, if you will accept a training position. It can be on Earth, on the Moon at double pay, on Charon at triple pay, or here at Stargate for quadruple pay. Furthermore, you don't have to make up your mind now. You're all getting a free trip back to Earth. I envy you. I haven't been back in 15 years. We'll probably never go back. And you can get the feel of being a civilian again. If you don't like it, just walk into any UNIF installation, and you'll walk out an officer. Your choice of assignment. Some of you are smiling. I think you ought to reserve judgment. Earth is not the same place you left." He pulled a little card out of his tunic and looked at it, smiling. "Most of you have something on the order of $400,000 coming to you, accumulated pay and interest. But Earth is on a war footing, and, of course, it is the citizens of Earth who are supporting the war. Your income puts you in a 92% income tax bracket. $32,000 might last you about 3 years, if you're careful. Eventually, You're going to have to get a job, and this is one job for which you are uniquely trained. There are not that many jobs available. The population of Earth is nearly 9 billion, with 5 or 6 billion unemployed. Also, keep in mind that your friends and sweethearts of 2 years ago are now going to be 21 years older than you. Many of your relatives will have passed away. I think you'll find it a very lonely world. But to tell you something about this world, I'm going to turn you over to Captain Siri, who just arrived from Earth. Captain?
Thank you, General. It looked as if there was something wrong with his skin, his face. And then I realized he was wearing powder and lipstick. His nails were smooth white almonds. I don't know where to begin. He sucked in his upper lip and looked at us, frowning. Things have changed so very much since I was a boy. I'm 23, so I was still in diapers when you people left for Aleph. To begin with, how many of you are homosexual?
Nobody.
That doesn't really surprise me. I am, of course. I guess about a third of everybody in Europe and America is. Most governments encourage homosexuality. The United Nations is neutral, leaves it up to the individual countries. They encourage homo life, mainly because it's the one sure method of birth control. That seemed specious to me. Our method of birth control in the army is pretty foolproof. All men making a deposit in the sperm bank, and then vasectomy. As the general said, the population of the world is 9 billion. It's more than doubled since you were drafted, and nearly two-thirds of those people get out of school only to go on relief. Speaking of school, how many years of public schooling did the government give you? He was looking at me, so I answered. 14? He nodded. It's 18 now. More if you don't pass your examinations, and you're required by law to pass your exams before you're eligible for any job or Class 1 relief. And, brother boy, anything besides Class 1 is hard to live on. Yes?
Hofstetter had his hand up.
Sir, is it 18 years public school in every country? Where do they find enough schools?
Oh, most people take the last 5 or 6 years at home or in a community center, via holoscreen. The UN has 40 or 50 information channels giving instruction 24 hours a day. But most of you won't have to concern yourselves with that. If you're in the force, you're already too smart by half. He brushed hair from his eyes in a thoroughly feminine gesture, pouting a little. Let me do some history to you. I guess the first really important thing that happened after you left was the Ration War. That was 2007. A lot of things happened at once. Locust plague in North America, rice blight from Burma to the South China Sea, red tides all along the west coast of South America. Suddenly, there just wasn't enough food to go around. The UN stepped in and took over food distribution. Every man, woman, and child got a ration booklet, allowing them to consume so many calories per month. If Tha went over their monthly allotment, Tha just went hungry until the first of the next month. Some of the new people we'd picked up after Aleph used Tha, their, them, instead of he, his, him, for the collective pronoun. I wondered whether it had become universal. Of course, an illegal market developed, and soon there was great inequality in the amount of food people in various strata of society consumed. A vengeance group in Ecuador, the Imparciales, systematically began to assassinate people who appeared to be well-fed. The idea caught on pretty quickly, and in a few months, there was a full-scale, undeclared class war going on all over the world. The United Nations managed to get things back under control in a year or so, by which time the population was down to 4 billion. Crops were more or less recovered, and the food crisis was over. they kept the rationing, but it's never been really severe again. Incidentally, the general translated the money coming to you into dollars, just for your own convenience. The world has only one currency now, calories. Your $32,000 comes to about 3,000 million calories, or 3 million Ks, kilocalories. Ever since the ration war, the UN has encouraged subsistence farming wherever it's practical. Food you grow yourself, of course, isn't rationed. It got people out of the cities onto UN farming reservations, which helped alleviate some urban problems. But subsistence farming seems to encourage large families, so the population of the world has more than doubled since the ration war. Also, we no longer have the abundance of electrical power I remember from boyhood, probably a good deal less than you remember. There are only a few places in the world where you can have power all day and night. They keep saying it's a temporary situation, but it's been going on for over a decade. He went on like that for a long time. Well, hell, it wasn't really surprising, much of it. We'd probably spent more time in the past 2 years talking about what home was going to be like than about anything else. Unfortunately, most of the bad things we'd prognosticated seemed to have come true, and not many of the good things. The worst thing for me, I guess, was that they'd taken over most of the good parkland and subdivided it into little farms. If you wanted to find some wilderness, you had to go someplace where they couldn't possibly make a plant grow. He said that the relations between people who chose homo life and the ones he called breeders were quite smooth. But I wondered. I never had much trouble accepting homosexuals myself, but then I'd never had to cope with such an abundance of them. He also said, in answer to an impolite question, that his powder and paint had nothing to do with his sexual orientation. It was just stylish. I decided I'd be an anachronism and just wear my face. I don't guess it should have surprised me that language had changed considerably in 20 years. My parents were always saying things were cool, joints were grass, and so on. We had to wait several weeks before we could get a ride back to Earth. We'd be going back on the anniversary. But first, she had to be taken apart and put back together again. Meanwhile, we were put in cozy little 2-man billets and released from all military responsibilities. Most of us spent our days down at the library, trying to catch up on 22 years of current events. Evenings, we'd get together at the Flowing Bowl, an NCO club. The privates, of course, weren't supposed to be there, but we found that nobody argues with a person who has 2 of the fluorescent battle ribbons. I was surprised that they served heroin fixes at the bar. The waiter said that you get a compensating shot to keep you from getting addicted to it. I got really stoned and tried one. Never again. Submajor Stott stayed at Stargate, where they were assembling a new strike force, Alpha. The rest of us boarded the anniversary and had a fairly pleasant 6-month journey. Cortez didn't insist on everything being capital M military, so it was a lot better than the trip from Yod 4. Chapter 8. I hadn't given it too much thought, but of course, we were celebrities on Earth, the first vets home from the war. The Secretary General greeted us at Kennedy, and we had a week-long whirl of banquets, receptions, interviews, and all that. It was enjoyable enough, and profitable. I made 1 million Ks from Time Life Facts. But we really saw a little of Earth, until after the novelty wore off, and we were more or less allowed to go our own way. I picked up the Washington monorail at Grand Central Station, and headed home. My mother had met me at Kennedy. Suddenly and sadly old, and told me my father was dead. Flyer accident. I was going to stay with her until I could get a job. She was living in Columbia, a satellite of Washington. She had moved back into the city after the ration war, having moved out in 1980. and then failing services and rising crime, had forced her out again. She was waiting for me at the monorail station. Beside her stood a blonde giant in a heavy black vinyl uniform, with a big gunpowder pistol on his hip and spiked brass knuckles on his right hand.
"William, this is Carl, my bodyguard, and very dear friend."
Carl slipped off the knuckles long enough to shake hands with surprising gentleness.
"Pleased to meet you, Mr. Mandela."
We got into a ground car that had Jefferson written on it in bright orange letters. I thought that was an odd thing to name a car, but then found out that it was the name of the high-rise Mother and Carl lived in. The ground car was one of several that belonged to the community, and she paid $100K per kilometer for the use of it. I had to admit that Columbia was rather pretty. Formal gardens and lots of trees and grass. Even the high-rises, roughly conical jumbles of granite with trees growing out at odd places, looked more like mountains than buildings. We drove into the base of one of these mountains, down a well-lit corridor, to where a number of other cars were parked. Carl carried my solitary bag to the elevator and set it down.
"Ms. Mandela, if is all right with you, I gots to go pick up Ms. Freeman in like 5. She over West Branch."
"Sure, Carl. William can take care of me. He's a soldier, you know."
That's right. I remember learning 8 silent ways to kill a man. Maybe if things got really tight, I could get a job like Carl's.
"Rightio, yeah, you told me. What's it like, man?"
"Mostly boring," I said automatically. "When you aren't bored, you're scared." He nodded wisely.
"That's what I heard. Ms. Mandela, I be available anytime after 6, rightio?"
"That's fine, Carl."
The elevator came and a tall, skinny boy stepped out, an unlit joint dangling from his lips. Carl ran his fingers over the spikes on his knuckles, and the boy walked rapidly away.
"Gots to watch out for them riders. Take care of yourself, Ms. Mandela."
We got on the elevator and Mother punched 47.
"What's a rider?"
"Oh, they're just young toughs who ride up and down the elevators looking for defenseless people without bodyguards. They aren't too much of a problem here."
The 47th floor was a huge mall filled with shops and offices. We went to a food store.
"Have you gotten your ration book yet, William?"
I told her I hadn't, but the force had given me travel tickets worth 100,000 calories, and I'd used up only half of them. It was a little confusing, but they'd explained it to us. When the world went on a single currency, they'd tried to coordinate it with the food rationing in some way, hoping to eventually eliminate the ration books, so they'd made the new currency Ks, kilo calories, because that's the unit for measuring the energy equivalent of food. But a person who eats 2,000 kilocalories of steak a day obviously has to pay more than a person eating the same amount of bread. So they instituted a sliding ration factor, so complicated that nobody could understand it. After a few weeks, they were using the books again, but calling food kilocalories calories in an attempt to make things less confusing. Seemed to me they'd save a lot of trouble all around if they'd just call money dollars again, or rubles, or sesterces, or whatever. Anything but kilocalories. Food prices were astonishing, except for grains and legumes. I insisted on splurging on some good red meat, 1,500 calories worth of ground beef, costing 1,730K. The same amount of fake steak, made from soybeans, would have cost 80K. I also got a head of lettuce for 140K and a little bottle of olive oil for 175K. Mother said she had some vinegar. Started to buy some mushrooms, but she said she had a neighbor who grew them and could trade something from her balcony garden.
At her apartment on the 92nd floor, she apologized for the smallness of the place. It didn't seem so little to me, but then she'd never lived on a spaceship. Even this high up, there were bars on the windows. The door had four separate locks, one of which didn't work, because somebody had used a crowbar on it. Mother went off to turn the ground beef into a meatloaf, and I settled down with the evening facts. She pulled some carrots from her little garden and called the mushroom lady, whose son came over to make the trade. He had a riot gun slung under his arm. "Mother, where's the rest of the star?" I called into the kitchen.
"As far as I know, it's all there. What were you looking for?"
"Well, I found the classified section, but no help wanted." She laughed.
"Son, there hasn't been a help wanted ad in 10 years. The government takes care of jobs. Well, most of them."
"Everybody works for the government?"
"No, that's not it."
She came in wiping her hands on a frayed towel.
"The government, they tell us, handles the distribution of all natural resources, and there aren't many resources more valuable than empty jobs."
"Well, I'll go talk to them tomorrow."
"Don't bother, son. How much retirement pay you say you're getting from the force?"
$20,000 a month. Doesn't look like it'll go far."
"No, it won't. But your father's pension gave me less than half that, and they wouldn't give me a job. Jobs are assigned on a basis of need. And you've got to be living on rice and water before the employment board considers you needy."
"Well, hell, it's a bureaucracy. There must be somebody I can pay off. Slip me into a good..."
"No. Sorry, that's one part of the UN that's absolutely incorruptible. The whole shebang is cybernetic, untouched by human souls."
"You can't."
"But you said you had a job." "I was getting to that. If you want a job badly enough, you can go to a dealer, and sometimes get a hand-me-down."
"Hand-me-down? Dealer?"
"Take my job as an example, son. A woman named Haley Williams has a job in a hospital, running a machine that analyzes blood, a chromatography machine. She works 6 nights a week for $12,000 a week. She gets tired of working, so she contacts a dealer and lets him know that her job is available. Sometime before this, I'd given the dealer his initial fee of $50,000 to get on his list. He comes by and describes the job to me, and I say, 'Fine, I'll take it.' He knew I would, and already has fake identification and a uniform. He distributes small bribes to the various supervisors who might know Miss Williams by sight. Miss Williams shows me how to run the machine, and quits. She still gets the weekly $12,000 credited to her account, but she pays me half. I pay the dealer 10% and wind up with $5,400 per week. This, added to the $9,000 I get monthly from your father's pension, makes me quite comfortable. Then it gets complicated. Finding myself with plenty of money and too little time, I contact the dealer again, offering to sublet half my job. The next day, a girl shows up who also has Haley Williams identification. I show her how to run the machine, and she takes over Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Half of my real salary is $2,700, so she gets half that, $1,350, and pays the dealer $135.
She got a pad and a stylus and did some figuring.
So the real Haley Williams gets $6,000 weekly for doing nothing. I work 3 days a week for $4,050. My assistant works 3 days for $1,115. The dealer gets $100,000 in fees and $735 per week. Lopsided, isn't it?
I'll say. Quite illegal, too, I suppose.
For the dealer, Everybody else might lose their job and have to start over if the employment board finds out. But the dealer gets brainwiped.
Guess I'd better find a dealer while I can still afford the 50 grand bite. Actually, I still had over 3 million, but planned to run through most of it in a short time. Hell, I'd earned it. I was getting ready to go the next morning when Mother came in with a shoebox. Inside there was a small pistol in a clip-on holster.
"This belonged to your father," she explained. "Better wear it if you're planning to go downtown without a bodyguard."
It was a gunpowder pistol with ridiculously thin bullets. I hefted it in my hand. "Did Dad ever use it?"
"Several times. Just to scare away riders and hitters, though. He never actually shot anybody."
"You're probably right that I need a gun," I said, putting it back. "But I'd have to have something with more heft to it. Can I buy one legally?"
"Sure. There's a gun store down in the mall. As long as you don't have a police record, you can buy anything that suits you."
"Good. I'd get a little pocket laser. I could hardly hit the wall with a gunpowder pistol."
"But, William, I'd feel a lot better if you'd hire a bodyguard, at least until you know your way around."
We'd gone all around that last night. Being an official trained killer, I thought I was tougher than any clown I might hire for the job. "I'll check into it, Mother. Don't worry, I'm not even going downtown today, just into Hyattsville."
"That's just as bad."
When the elevator came, it was already occupied. He looked at me blandly as I got in, a man a little older than me, clean-shaven and well-dressed. He stepped back to let me at the row of buttons. I punched 47, and then, realizing his motive might not have been politeness, turned to see him struggling to get in a metal pipe stuck in his waistband. It had been hidden by his cape. "Come on, fella," I said, reaching for a non-existent weapon. "You want to get caulked?"
He had the pipe free, but let it hang loosely at his side.
"Caulked?"
"Killed. Army term." I took one step toward him, trying to remember. Kick just under the knee, then either groin or kidney. I decided on the groin.
"No."
He put the pipe back in his waistband. "I don't want to get caulked."
The door opened at 47, and I backed out. The gun shop was all bright white plastic and gleamy black metal. A little bald man bobbed over to wait on me. He had a pistol and a shoulder rig.
"And a fine morning to you, sir,"
he said, and giggled.
"What will it be today?"
"Lightweight pocket laser," I said. "Carbon dioxide." He looked at me quizzically and then brightened.
"Coming right up, sir."
Giggle.
"Special today. I throw in a handful of tachyon grenades."
"Fine. They'd be handy." He looked at me expectantly.
"So, what's the popper?"
"Huh?"
"The punch, man. You set me up, now knock me down. Laser."
He giggled. I was beginning to understand. "You mean I can't buy a laser?"
"Of course not, sweetie,"
he said and sobered.
"You didn't know that?"
"I've been out of the country for a long time."
"The world, you mean? You've been out of the world a long time."
He put his left hand on a chubby hip in a gesture that incidentally made his gun easier to get. He scratched the center of his chest. I stood very still. "That's right. I just got out of the force." His jaw dropped.
"Hey, no bully bull? You been out shooting 'em up out in space?"
"That's right."
"Hey, all that crap about you not getting older. There's nothing to that, is there?"
"Oh, it's true. I was born in 1975.
"Well, God... damn, you're almost as old as I am."
He giggled.
I thought that was just something the government made up.
Anyhow, you say I can't buy a laser?
Oh, no. No, no, no. I run a legal shop here.
What can I buy?
Oh, pistol, rifle, shotgun, knife, body armor. Just no lasers, or explosives, or fully automatic weapons.
Let me see a pistol, the biggest you have.
Ah, I've got just the thing.
He motioned me over to a display case and opened the back, taking out a huge revolver.
410-gauge six-shooter.
He cradled it in both hands.
Dinosaur stopper. Authentic Old West styling. Slugs or flechettes?
Flechettes?
Sure. They're like a bunch of tiny darts. You shoot, and they spread out in a pattern. Hard to miss that way.
Sounded like my speed. Any place I can try it out?
Course, of course. We have a range in back. Let me get my assistant.
He rang a bell, and a boy came out to watch the store while we went in back. He picked up a red and green box of shotgun shells on the way. The range was in two sections, a little anteroom with a plastic transparent door, and a long corridor on the other side of the door, with a table at one end and targets at the other. Behind the targets was a sheet of metal that evidently deflected the bullets down into a pool of water. He loaded the pistol and set it on the table.
Please don't pick it up until the door is closed.
He went into the anteroom, closed the door, and picked up a microphone.
Okay. First time, you better hold onto it with both hands.
I did so, raising it up in line with the center target, a square of paper looking about the size of your thumbnail at arm's length. Doubted I'd even come near it. I pulled the trigger, and it went back easily enough, but nothing happened.
No, no,
he said over the microphone with a tinny giggle.
Authentic Old West styling. You've got to pull the hammer back.
Sure, just like in the flicks. I hauled the hammer back, lined it up again, and squeezed the trigger. The noise was so loud it made my face sting. The gun bucked up and almost hit me on the forehead, but the three center targets were gone. Just tiny tatters of paper drifting in the air. I'll take it. He sold me a hip holster, 20 shells, and a chest and back shield, and a dagger in a boot sheath. I felt more heavily armed than I had in a fighting suit, but no Waldos to help me cart it around. The monorail had two guards for each car. I was beginning to feel that all my heavy artillery was superfluous. Until I got off at the Hyattsville station. Everyone who got off at Hyattsville was either heavily armed or had a bodyguard. The people loitering around the station were all armed. The police carried lasers. I pushed a cab call button, and the readout told me mine would be number 3856. I asked a policeman, and he told me to wait for it down on the street. It would cruise around the block twice. During the 5 minutes I waited, I twice heard staccato arguments of gunfire, both of them rather far away. I was glad I'd bought the shield. Eventually the cab came. It swerved to the curb when I waved at it, the door sliding open as it stopped. Looked as if it worked the same way as the auto cabs I remembered. The door stayed open while it checked the thumbprint to verify that I was the one who had called. Then slammed shut. It was thick steel. The view through the windows was dim and distorted, probably thick bulletproof plastic. Not quite the same as I remembered. I had to leaf through a grimy book to find the code for the address of the bar in Hyattsville, where I was supposed to meet the dealer. I punched it out and sat back to watch the city go by. This part of town was mostly residential. Gray brick warrens built around the middle of the last century, competing for space with more modern modular setups, and occasionally individual houses behind tall brick or concrete walls
with jagged broken glass and barbed wire at the top. A few people seemed to be going somewhere, walking very quickly down the sidewalks, hands on weapons. Most of the people I saw were either sitting in doorways, smoking, or loitering around shop fronts in groups of no fewer than six. Everything was dirty and cluttered. The gutters were clotted with garbage, and shoals of waste paper drifted with the wind of the light traffic. It was understandable, though. Street sweeping was probably a very high-risk profession. The cab pulled up in front of Tom and Jerry's Bar and Grill, and let me out after I paid $430K. I stepped to the sidewalk with my hand on the shotgun pistol, but there was nobody around. I hustled into the bar. It was surprisingly clean on the inside, dimly lit and furnished in fake leather and fake pine. I went to the bar and got some fake bourbon, and presumably real water for $120K. The water cost $20K. A waitress came over with a tray.
"Pop one, brother boy?"
The tray had a rack of old-fashioned hypodermic needles.
"Not today, thanks."
If I was going to pop one, I'd use an aerosol. The needles looked unsanitary and painful. She set the dope down on the bar and eased onto the stool next to me. She sat with her chin cupped in her palm and stared at her reflection in the mirror behind the bar.
"God, Tuesdays."
I mumbled something.
"You want to go in back for a quickie?"
I looked at her with what I hoped was a neutral expression. She was wearing only a short skirt of some gossamer material, and it plunged in a shallow V in the front, exposing her hip bones and a few bleached pubic hairs. I wondered what could possibly keep it up. She wasn't bad-looking, could have been anywhere from her late 20s to her early 40s. No telling what they could do with cosmetic surgery and makeup nowadays, though. Maybe she was older than my mother.
"Thanks anyhow."
"Not today?"
"That's right."
"I can get you a nice boy if..."
"No, no thanks."
What a world. She pouted into the mirror, an expression that was probably older than Homo sapiens.
"You don't like me."
"I like you fine. That's just not what I came here for."
"Well, different funds for different ones."
She shrugged.
"Hey, Jerry, get me a short beer."
He brought it.
"Oh, damn, my purse is locked up. Mister, can you spare 40 calories?
I had enough ration tickets to take care of a whole banquet. Tore off a 50 and gave it to the bartender.
"Jesus."
She stared.
"How'd you get a full book at the end of the month?"
I told her in as few words as possible who I was and how I managed to have so many calories. There had been 2 months' worth of books waiting in my mail, and I hadn't even used up the ones the force had given me. She offered to buy a book from me for $10,000, but I didn't want to get involved in more than one illegal enterprise at a time. Two men came in, one unarmed and the other with both a pistol and a riot gun. The bodyguard sat by the door, and the other came over to me.
"Mr. Mandela?"
"That's right."
"Shall we take a booth?"
He didn't offer his name. He had a cup of coffee, and I sipped a mug of beer.
"I don't keep any written records, but I have an excellent memory. Tell me, what sort of a job you're interested in, what your qualifications are, what salary you'll accept, and so on."
I told him I'd prefer to wait for a job where I could use my physics, teaching or research, even engineering. I wouldn't need a job for 2 or 3 months, since I planned to travel and spend money for a while. Wanted at least $20,000 monthly, but how much I'd accept would depend on the nature of the job. He didn't say a word until I'd finished.
"Rightio. Now, I'm afraid you'd have a hard time getting a job in physics. Teaching is out. I can't supply jobs where the person is constantly exposed to the public. Research, well, your degree is almost a quarter of a century old.
You'd have to go back to school, maybe 5 or 6 years. Might do that, I said. The one really marketable feature you have is your combat experience. I could probably place you in a supervisory job at a bodyguard agency for even more than 20 grand. You could make almost that much being a bodyguard yourself.
Thanks, but I wouldn't want to take chances for somebody else's hide.
Rightio, can't say I blame you.
He finished his coffee in a long slurp.
Well, I've got to run, got 1,000 things to do. I'll keep you in mind and talk to some people.
Good, I'll see you in a few months.
Rightio, don't need to make an appointment. I come in here every day at 11 for coffee. Just show up.
I finished my beer and called a cab to take me home. I wanted to walk around the city, but Mother was right. I'd get a bodyguard first. Chapter 9. I came home and the phone was blinking, pale blue. Didn't know what to do, so I punched operator. A pretty young girl's head materialized in the cube.
"Jefferson operator," she said. "May I help you?"
"Yes, what does it mean when the cube is blinking blue?"
"Huh?
What does it mean when the phone..."
"Are you serious?"
I was getting a little tired of this kind of thing. "It's a long story, honest. I don't know."
"When it blinks blue, you're supposed to call the operator."
"Okay, here I am."
"No, not me. The real operator. Punch 9, then punch 0.
I did that, and an old harridan appeared.
"Obareda."
"This is William Mandela at 301-525-74-3975. I was supposed to call you."
"Just a second."
She reached outside the field of view and typed something.
"You got a call from 605-19-556-2027.
I scribbled it down on the pad by the phone. "Where's that?"
"Just a second. South Dakota."
"Thanks." I didn't know anybody in South Dakota. A pleasant-looking old woman answered the phone.
"Yes?"
"I had a call from this number. I'm..."
"Oh, Sergeant Mandela, just a second."
I watched the diagonal bar of the holding pattern for a second, then 50 or so more. Then a head came into focus. Mary Gay.
"William, I had a heck of a time finding you."
"Darling, me too. What are you doing in South Dakota?"
"My parents live here, in a little commune. That's why it took me so long to get to the phone."
She held up 2 grimy hands.
"Digging potatoes."
"But when I checked, the records said..." "The records in Tucson said your parents were both dead."
"No, they're just dropouts. You know about dropouts? New name, new life? I got the word through a cousin."
"Well. Well, have you been? Like the country life?"
"That's one reason I've been wanting to get you. Willie, I'm bored. It's all very healthy and nice, but I want to do something dissipated and wicked. Naturally, I thought of you."
"I'm flattered. Pick you up at 8? She checked a clock above the phone.
"No. Look, let's get a good night's sleep. Besides, I've got to get in the rest of the potatoes. Meet me at the Ellis Island Jetport at 10 tomorrow morning. Transworld Information Desk."
"Okay. Make reservations for where?" She shrugged.
"Pick a place."
"London used to be pretty wicked."
"Sounds good. First class?"
"What else?" "I'll get us a suite on one of the dirigibles."
"Good. Decadent. How long shall I pack for?"
"We'll buy clothes along the way. Travel light. Just 1 stuffed wallet apiece." She giggled.
"Wonderful. Tomorrow at 10.
"Fine. Mary Gay, do you have a gun?"
"It's that bad?"
"Here around Washington it is."
"Well, I'll get one. Dad has a couple over the fireplace. Guess they're left over from Tucson.
We'll hope we won't need them.
Willie, you know it'll just be for decoration. I couldn't even kill a tauren.
Of course. We just looked at each other for a second. Tomorrow at 10, then.
Right. Love you.
Ah. She giggled again and hung up. That was just too many things to think about, all at once. I got us two round-the-world dirigible tickets. Unlimited stops, as long as you kept going east. It took me a little over 2 hours to get to Ellis by autocab and monorail. I was early, but so was Mary Gay. She was talking to the girl at the desk and didn't see me coming. Her outfit was really arresting. A tight coverall of plastic in a pattern of interlocking hands. As your angle of sight changed, various strategic hands became transparent. She had a ruddy sun glow all over her body. I don't know whether the feeling that rushed over me was simple, honest lust or something more complicated. I hurried up behind her, whispering,
"What are we going to do for 3 hours?"
She turned and gave me a quick hug and thanked the girl at the desk, then grabbed my hand and pulled me along to a slidewalk. Where are we headed?
Don't ask questions, Sergeant. Just follow me.
We stepped onto a roundabout and transferred to an eastbound slidewalk.
Do you want something to eat or drink?
She asked innocently. I tried to leer. Any alternatives? She laughed gaily. Several people stared.
Just a second. Here.
We jumped off. It was a corridor marked roomettes. She handed me a key. That damned plastic coverall was held on by static electricity. Since the roomette was nothing but a big waterbed, I almost broke my neck the first time it shocked me. I recovered. We were lying on our stomachs, looking through the one-way glass wall at the people rushing around down on the concourse. Mary Gay passed me a joint.
William, have you used that thing yet?
What thing?
That hog leg, the pistol.
Only shot it once in the store where I bought it.
Do you really think you could point it at someone and blow him apart?
I took a shallow puff and passed it back. Hadn't given it much thought, really, until we talked last night.
Well?
I don't really know. The only time I've killed was on Aleph, under hypnotic compulsion. But I don't think it would bother me, not that much, not if the person was trying to kill me in the first place. Why should it?
Life, she said plaintively.
Life is a bunch of cells walking around with a common purpose. If that common purpose is to get my ass...
Oh, William, you sound like old Cortez.
Cortez kept us alive.
Not many of us, she snapped.
I rolled over and studied the ceiling tiles. She traced little designs on my chest, pushing the sweat around with her fingertip.
I'm sorry, William. I guess we're both just trying to adjust.
That's okay. You're right, anyhow. We talked for a long time. The only urban center Mary Gay had been to since our publicity rounds, which were very sheltered, was Sioux Falls. She had gone with her parents and the commune bodyguard. It sounded like a scaled-down version of Washington. The same problems, but not as acute. We ticked off the things that bothered us. Violence, high cost of living, too many people everywhere. I'd have added homo life, but Mary Gay said I just didn't appreciate the social dynamic that had led to it. It had been inevitable. The only thing she said she had against it was that it took so many of the prettiest men out of circulation. And the main thing that was wrong was that everything seemed to have gotten just a little worse, or at best remained the same. You would have predicted that at least a few facets of everyday life would improve markedly in 22 years. Her father contended the war was behind it all,
Any person who showed a shred of talent was sucked up by UNIF. The very best fell to the Elite Conscription Act and wound up being cannon fodder. It was hard not to agree with him. Wars in the past often accelerated social reform, provided technological benefits, even sparked artistic activity. This one, however, seemed tailor-made to provide none of these positive byproducts. Such improvements as had been made on late 20th century technology were, like tachyon bombs and warships 2 kilometers long, at best interesting developments of things that only required the synergy of money and existing engineering techniques. Social reform? The world was technically under martial law. As for art, I'm not sure I know good from bad, but artists, to some extent, have to reflect the temper of the times. Paintings and sculpture were full of torture and dark brooding. Movies seemed static and plotless. Music was dominated by nostalgic revivals of earlier forms. Architecture was mainly concerned with finding some place to put everybody. Literature was damn near incomprehensible. Most people seemed to spend most of their time trying to find ways to outwit the government, trying to scrounge a few extra K's or ration tickets without putting their lives in too much danger. And in the past, people whose country was at war were constantly in contact with the war. The newspapers would be full of reports. Veterans would return from the front. Sometimes the front would move right into town, invaders marching down Main Street or bombs whistling through the night air, but always the sense of either working toward victory or at least delaying defeat. The enemy was a tangible thing, a propagandist's monster, whom you could understand, whom you could hate. But this war... The enemy was a curious organism, only vaguely understood, more often the subject of cartoons than nightmares. The main effect of the war on the home front was economic, unemotional, more taxes, but more jobs as well. After 22 years, only 27 returned veterans, not enough to make a decent parade. The most important fact about the war to most people was that if it ended suddenly, Earth's economy would collapse. You approached the dirigible by means of a small propeller-driven aircraft that drifted up to match trajectories and docked alongside. A clerk took our baggage, and we checked our weapons with the purser, then went outside. Just about everybody on the flight was standing out on the promenade deck, watching Manhattan creep toward the horizon. It was an eerie sight. The day was very still, so the bottom 30 or 40 stories of the buildings were buried in smog. It looked like a city built on a cloud, a thunderhead floating. We watched it for a while, and then went inside to eat. The meal was elegantly served and simple. Filet of beef, 2 vegetables, wine, cheese and fruit, and more wine for dessert. No fiddling with ration tickets. A loophole in the rationing laws implied that they were not required for meals consumed en route, on intercontinental transport.
This ends Disc 4.